Time is now 10:28. Mr. Westfall.
I'd like to make a few comments, and then Ms. Corey would like just to make a few comments, and I think this will be relatively short. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to go out and sort of, you know, go through all of my notes and say, as to, again, try to avoid the temptation of trying to do a point-by-point rebuttal. I greatly respect Ms. Hart's passion and desire to want to propose some sort of alternative, but the alternative needs to be clearly expressed to the voters. If what they want is something that preserves certain preferences and preferential treatment, and then they've got to put that on the ballot. The time and time again through the hour colloquy, I heard virtually nothing talking about discrimination. I heard talking about the kinds of programs that they want to preserve. It should be abundantly clear to the three of you that that's the purpose of this measure. And if they want to have it to be a dueling 61 versus 31 and saying this is our vision, this is what we're preserving, then articulate it. Don't have it be concerning a prohibition against discrimination. Don't put the second sentence out as its own measure. I can't imagine that, I mean, maybe I'll be wrong, we'll see what they come up with, but something that did what she's saying they want to do is easily draftable. We've got plenty of time. We're early March. They've got plenty of time to go back to the drawing board, but I strongly urge the title board to send them back to the drawing board. Make them come up with a title, or excuse me, a measure that you can draw, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning, fill in that blank, whatever it is, whether it's maintenance of certain preferential treat programs or certain defining discrimination to mean such and such a thing. Make them fill in the blank on the measure itself as to after the word concerning, so the single subject is clear to the voters and not misleading. That's all we ask. And I won't belabor it. Again, oh, did I lose my...
Oh, I have a question for you, though, well... Okay.
I should let her go first.
Something that Mr. Corrado said struck me. And I'll probably mischaracterize this quite a bit, but it seemed like there's a point of view maybe that number 31 and number 61 are really very similar. They both are prohibiting discrimination. What's the only thing that's different is the exceptions.
And I have to say that's incredibly clever, Mr. Corrado, but it's exactly, I mean, I fundamentally disagree with his characterization. One is specifically designed to do exactly the opposite of 31, to preserve certain preferential treatment. That is the very purpose. I understand his argument, and I think it's a very clever argument. I just fundamentally disagree with it. They're not just different in type. They're different in the very structure of what they're trying to accomplish. And the voters need to understand that if there's going to be dueling measures on the ballot. Don't hide behind concerning a prohibition against discrimination. That's not what 61 is about at all. I fundamentally disagree with that.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Westfall? Then I don't know whether you're going to take over child care duties now.
Oh. I think Ms. Corey has a few remarks.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, members of the board. My name is Jessica Peck Corey, and maybe you didn't know, but it's Take Your Daughter to Work Day. So I have my three-month-old Caroline here with me, and thank you for being so gracious and allowing her here in the room. I come here today as a citizen and one who is a strong supporter of the initiative process and also a strong supporter of equal opportunity in this country. I decided to seek the guidance of Mr. Westfall on this issue because I believe that the language of 61 is fraudulent, and we don't need to go over the specifics of that. But I strongly believe that if we went out and rounded up 10 voters on the street right outside here on Broadway, the vast majority of them would not understand what this initiative is attempting to do. This is a sentiment articulated yesterday in the Rocky Mountain News editorial pages, and it's a reasonable one. Like Mr. Westfall said, we aren't here in an effort to kill the act of dialogue. We're here to get it started, and we're here to get it started on honest terms. The proponents of 61 have plenty of time to go back and to create language that allows for that genuine debate. The last thing that I want to talk about is that we hear from the proponents of 61 continuously that 31 would kill all valid, or at least a substantial number of valid equal opportunity programs, targeted recruitment, that sort of thing. As a member of the Blue Ribbon Commission on Diversity at the University of Colorado, appointed by Hank Brown, I have to strenuously disagree with that and say that every race-neutral program that is perpetuated by the University of Colorado or any university in the state will be allowed to go forward and flourish. And if that at all, whether or not those programs are allowed or disallowed, factors into your decision, please know that after spending 16 months analyzing these programs, I believe they will not be affected. Thank you so much for your time and consideration. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify. I would like, is there somebody else? Yes, sir.
Oh. I'm Andrew Paredes, my proponent.
Okay, if you will come forward.
Is it okay?
Yes. Please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Okay. My name is Andrew Paredes, and I'm one of the proponents of proposed Initiative 61. Whew, and I'm nervous.
Okay. Would you spell your last name,
please? It is P-A-R-E-D-E-S.
Thank you.
For the record, I am not an attorney, don't study law. I am a voter, and so I and a proponent, and so I think I can maybe speak accurately to what an average voter who's not an expert in the law might think. And it was ours, my proponents, and my intention to file this amendment to give a competing way of looking at the prohibition of discrimination and preferential treatment. So at issue is the fact that there should be no discrimination, and there may be 5, 2, 6, 14 different ways of going about doing that. We have thoughts and we are trying to articulate a way and put on the ballot a way to go about doing that we think is the best way to do it. And that is the purpose of the initiative, and we may have in this discussion spent a lot of time talking about the particular second sentence, because there is not much discussion needed about the first sentence. That seems to be hashed out, and that seems to be fairly self-evident. So our intention with this is to put on the ballot a way to deal with discrimination, but the way that we think would be the best way to go about doing that, and hopefully it will be set and up to the voters to hash it all out and make their decision.
Okay, thank you very much. Question? Okay, thank you. And Ms. Hart, I'll give you one more minute if you need it. We've got two other measures we want to get to, but if you would like the time, I want to give you a fair chance. Okay, thank you. Then I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board?
Well, I'll start. I mean, I think I was pretty clear last time that I had real problems with this, and as I say, I appreciate what the proponents are trying to do. I don't agree or even really care whether they intend to be misleading or deceptive. I don't want to characterize their efforts that way. I think this is a good faith effort. It's clearer to me than ever that this really is the kind of thing that the prohibition against confusing or deceptive, in the sense of not of intentionally deceptive, but of measures that contain things that the average voter would be surprised and confused by. It's quite clear to me that that's what would happen here. And I mean, the Supreme Court has very clearly said that certain, at least racial preferences, are constitutional. They use that language. So it doesn't require really any speculation on our part that the second sentence does something that the first sentence purports to the second sentence allows something that the first sentence purports to prohibit. Now, the proponents, I think, would like to, for state constitutional purposes, what I'm hearing is they would like to say that what the Supreme Court is upholding do not amount to racial preferences, and they could do that. And as I say, I think it's a valuable exercise to have the debate over what are proper forms of preferences, because frankly, I think there's a lot less disagreement about that than there seems to be about these broader terms. And so I encourage them, if the board agrees with me and we vote down this measure, to come back with something that more clearly seeks to define those terms. But this doesn't do that. And I think it is just exactly the type of measure that the deceptive or surreptitious language that the Supreme Court has given us, and I know Ms. Eubanks said that there was a standard that the Supreme Court has given for single subject, which if she's been able to find one standard, I'd like to hear it. There seem to be many standards. But part of the analysis is definitely that a measure can't contain things that typical voters would be misled by. And I think that including a blanket prohibition and then essentially a blanket unprohibition in the second sentence, which is what this seems to do, is misleading and would be confusing. And I don't think the second sentence really can be properly viewed as just exceptions the way that Amendment 31 contained exceptions. It really is kind of a complete flip of the first sentence. And I certainly hope that the proponents don't think that this should prevent them from coming back with something else. I agree with Mr. Carrata, as I think I said, that this is a valuable debate, and it may be the best way to have the debate is to have competing propositions. I just think that this particular measure is misleading in a way that we can't set a title for it, as I think the efforts to set a title so far show that it's essentially impossible to set a clear title. And the reason for that is because the measure itself is essentially self-contradictory and confusing.
Ms. Eubanks?
So many things, so little time. I think where I want to start is the discussion that we had at our last meeting, and at least the position that I advocated at that point in time in terms of, one, the title board not getting into the business of trying to determine the effect of a measure. And I think the court has generally been clear that that is not our role and something that we should not do. But in terms of the arguments that have been made both by Mr. Westfall as well as other members of this board, I had to go back to the case law to try to get a little bit more guidance or see if we could find any guidance in terms of where do we draw the line between trying to being able to determine what a measure does in a manner sufficient to determine whether it constitutes a single subject without crossing that line of a determination of what its impact or effect may be. And I did find some very helpful language in a fairly recent decision of the Supreme Court, and that is the decision on number 55. And that measure was the one that involved the restrictions on non-emergency services, and in which the court struck down the measure as containing more than one subject. And it was very helpful because they had a very detailed discussion, again emphasizing the fact that we should not be as the title board, making a determination as to the effect of a measure, but that we definitely have to analyze a measure to fulfill our duty to determine whether a single subject exists. And so in light of that, in trying to balance what the court has told us in that regard, that gets me to some of the issues that I've been asking questions about. Things like the language of the second sentence in subsection 1 of number 61, what it may or may not apply to, what its effect is in terms of, at least, is it constitutionalizing perhaps current as well as future Supreme Court decisions in this area. And perhaps one way of characterizing this measure is where I started out at the last meeting, which is a prohibition with an exception, whether, as Mr. Westfall would characterize it, the exception that swallows the prohibition, whether, as Ms. Hart explains it, in terms of ensuring that certain types of programs, which she characterizes as equal opportunity programs, are preserved, whether it's characterized perhaps as more appropriately as preserving the status quo, and I base that on some of the responses to my questions about if you have a program or service that, for example, is based on race and it doesn't meet the standards that have been set forth by the U.S. Supreme Court, what happens? It doesn't continue to exist. That perhaps this measure is constitutionalizing the status quo in terms of what currently isn't allowed, as well as those types of programs, however you may characterize them, that are allowed under the U.S. Constitution. And that's in terms of that constitutionalizing that case law, both supporting certain types of programs and striking down certain programs. So I think there's different ways of characterizing and trying to understand this measure for purposes of single subject analysis. Now, in terms of those different options, I don't know that I'm in the same place that I was 2 weeks ago. And it's interesting because in my discussion with Ms. Hart, we talked about the fact that other cases dealing with voter surprise, voter fraud, tended to be lengthy, things were very hidden. Those were the concerns that the court had. As Mr. Westfall said, you know, this measure obviously is not lengthy, but is complex. And I think that the fact that even what was at issue in number 55 was a very short initiative. It contained three sentences. And yet the court found that because it was vague on its face, that it included purposes that would surprise the voters if they voted on that measure and then found out that it had this purpose and application. And so I don't know that obviously it's 61 is different than most of the cases dealing with voter surprise and fraud, but I do think that 55 is very helpful in understanding that even a short measure can be complex and may be worded in a way that does not allow voters from knowing what they're voting on. It's a very tough call. I don't know if for folks that aren't attorneys whether or not they will know what the language in that second sentence of subsection 1 will mean, and whether or not you have sort of the log rolling threat because they think they understand the first sentence and perhaps don't understand what the second sentence may mean in terms of an exception or preservation of certain types of programs. They may vote for this and then find out, just like in 43, the court's discussion of they think they're getting rid of the single subject requirement, and yet they find out that for certain measures they weren't getting rid of the single subject requirement. I think there is that potential with this measure. I think in terms of voters knowing from the language of the measure the effect of a yes or no vote may be questionable based on the language of the measure itself. I agree, I think, with Mr. Hobbs' comment that if we were to find that this measure constitutes a single subject, I'm not sure that the title that we said at the meeting 2 weeks ago contains a statement of that single subject. I think that would have to be revisited if we get that far. But for the time being, in terms of the single subject issue, I think that the vagueness of the measure, I mean, looking at the difficulty that this board has had in trying to ascertain and understand the meaning of that language, I think is indicative of the problems that it may cause to the voters in terms of being misleading or being fraudulent in terms of them not understanding what it is that they're voting on. I don't make these comments lightly. I think that this board has always been very aware of the importance of our decisions, and we take that responsibility very seriously. I just feel, especially in light of the guidance that the court has given us, especially in number 43 and number 55, that at this point that the measure doesn't meet the single subject requirements, multiple as they may be, and I think I was referring specifically to the test that the court has set forth, and I agree that the court has given us very many differing concepts to take into consideration when determining whether a measure has a single subject. And I think primarily because of the vagueness of the language of the second sentence, that the measure does not constitute a single subject.
Just to highlight your difficulty with that second sentence, and it does seem simple, but I've got in front of me, but the second sentence pulls within it basically all of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this point, and I've got two of the more recent cases in front of me, the parents involved case, which Ms. Hart cited, and Grutter, which I cited. And parents involved is 104 pages long, and Grutter is 89 pages in the report. So I think that highlights the sort of, I hesitate to say, deceptive simplicity of the length of the measure. It's really quite complex and difficult to understand.
Well, I agree with the comments made by Mr. Domenico and Ms. Eubanks, and reluctantly agree with their conclusions. I and reluctantly, because I do think it's important that the board be very cautious about being an obstacle to petitioners, except that here we really do have some obligations under the statute and the Constitution and the what the court has told us. And you know, and I'm going to try to avoid repeating the comments of Mr. Domenico and Ms. Eubanks, but I really think this is a very difficult measure for the board to understand, and the Supreme Court has said that if we cannot understand it well enough to set a title, then we cannot set a title. And I don't know how to set a title for this measure, a fair title that expresses a single subject. I think it really is different than number 31, and number 31 was a struggle, and I think it was a struggle for me personally, and I think for the board, and I think for the court. But to me, it was at least the struggle was understandable, and it had to do with, you know, what is discrimination, and at least I think it was understandable. Here, I think because of the uncertainty about the meaning of the second sentence, it's a different situation, and I don't know how to express in the titles what the measure is doing. You know, we could go with what the titles we set, but I don't think a voter can understand what the measure does reading the titles that we set. And I think the reason is because of the uncertainties about what the second sentence means. I really did try to look at this as maybe it's just a question of two measures, number 31 and number 61, that each prohibit discrimination and each have their own approach to what exceptions there should be. But number 31, I think the exceptions were actually clear in that case, and I think we expressed them in the title. And I don't think that was the struggle that we had. Here we really are struggling with what is permitted in light of the first sentence's prohibition on discrimination. And I go back to, a question that I raised earlier in this discussion, and that is it just still seems to me that that voters would, you know, seeing a measure that says it prohibits discrimination would be surprised to find that, in fact, it permits preferential treatment to the extent permitted by the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's the way I understand the measure, and I think that kind of goes back to and, well, supports the discussions about the measure being misleading. And again, I agree with Mr. Domenico. I don't want to characterize people's motives. I don't think that's relevant here, but I think the measure is inherently misleading because of the way it's drafted. And so I think I would also be a no vote on finding that the measure is a single subject. If there is no other discussion, I think a motion would be in order. I think, not sure what the proper motion is, but I'll take a stab at it. I think I'll move that the board grant the motion for rehearing and find that the measure does not comprise a single subject, and strike the titles that were set at the last hearing.
I'll second that motion.
Is there any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 61. The time is 10:57 a.m. Thank you. Thank you. Let's go on to the next agenda item. This is 2007-2008, number 57, criminal and civil liability of businesses and individuals for business activities. The time is 11 a.m. And now sitting as the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services is Dan Carton. We have a motion for rehearing, written motion for rehearing submitted by Mr. Friednash, so I'd like to hear from him first, if we could, please. Mr. Friednash, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record, and we've read your brief, but whatever highlights you would like to stress, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you. Good morning. Doug Friednash, appearing on behalf of Joe Blake. We filed the motion for rehearing. I'm not going to regurgitate my motion for rehearing. You'll be happy to hear. I will try to make my comments as brief as possible and want to focus on a few things. First, just to recap what the measure does. It does, and I know we've talked before, I'm not going to focus on the third component of this, which is what I felt was the third subject, that being this expenditure issue. But I am going to focus on the first two, which are it takes an existing criminal statute and it imposes criminal liability to businesses, that's the current law, that have either a passive act of knowing and not doing anything or don't specifically perform an act required by law. And it extends that to all employees of a company, low-level employees, HR, I think agents, which would probably include independent contractors, officers and directors. And as you know, criminal statute has a different standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. And the statute itself has a subsection dealing with fines that only seem to apply to businesses and not the rest of this universe of people, the employees, et cetera, high managerial agents and so forth. And we believe that's one very specific, distinct subject. The second one is it allows any color resident to file a civil lawsuit based on a passive act of knowing and not doing anything or not performing an act required by law. And again, this is an expansion. Now, this civil private right of action creates liability to business. That's new, obviously. The employees of that business, officers and directors, again, high managerial agents or employees alike. It basically creates a private right of action in each Colorado resident. So we have 3 million private attorney generals in the state. They don't need to be injured. As long as they have a $156 filing fee, they can file a civil complaint in the state and may be filing separate and distinct. There may be a lot of complaints being filed over the same issues that somebody just reads something in a newspaper over. And the standard, unlike the criminal standard, beyond a reasonable doubt, the civil standard is a preponderance of the evidence. The central theme of this topic is simply, you know, business liability. It falls kind of, and I think that's what we discussed last week. And I think simply characterizing the topic as business liability is too broad and general a concept to satisfy the single subject requirement. And I want to kind of go through some examples, I think, that are kind of indicative of why I think the public's going to be surprised by this, why they're going to be confused about this, and why it's misleading. A low-level employee who is cognizant that the company he works for may be polluting or is polluting somewhere, but it's not that person's responsibility to do anything under current law. Current law doesn't provide a basis of liability. This law does, and it imposes upon every person that's aware of something like this to file a notice with the Attorney General's office. I'm not sure how that's going to proceed, but they have to notify the Attorney General in order to protect themselves against being charged civilly or criminally. Illegal immigration is another good example. You could have knowledge that the company you work for may be hiring illegal immigrants. You could be an HR director. You may receive some false information from an employer. You may not know it's false, or maybe you work for the HR person, or you're just aware of somebody coming into your office that you think is illegal immigrant. That's another classic example of where litigation can come. And it's not just civil litigation, it's criminal litigation. I think the issues is disconcerting for a variety of reasons. And obviously, if you look at 55, I know that this panel just discussed that, the board just discussed that in relationship to the last issue. You had the concept of non-emergency services and this category, concept of non-emergency services, and the court found there were two unrelated purposes that were grouped under the broad theme of restricting non-emergency services, decreasing taxpayer expenditures that benefit welfare of members of target group, and denying access to other administrative services. In Ray Public Waters, in Ray Public Rights and Waters 2, these are just a couple cases I've highlighted in the motion, the court found that grouping distinct purposes of water conservation district elections and the public trust doctrine under the theme of water didn't satisfy the single subject because the connection was too broad in general. And there are other examples. This measure, you know, does those two separate and distinct things. I mean, they impose criminal liability on one hand and extend that for a variety of things and new substantive crimes that I think the public is not going to understand or be aware of. They're going to be hidden from them. Criminal liability can be based on the criminal component can be satisfied by a civil wrong. In other words, I think that an employee of a company who breaches a fiduciary duty, employee of a company who has a duty of fidelity or duty to warn or duty to act in good faith, these basic duties can be prosecuted in a criminal manner. So it expands, I think, creates, you know, potentially dozens of new crimes. The civil component creates, again, a number of new civil wrongs that can be created and prosecuted basically by any resident of the state in the court system, with the damages from that going to the general fund, which are then exempted from state spending limits. The concern I have with respect, and I'm going to, in the interest of time, address everything I think at once. I think that'll help things go a little smoother. But one of the concerns I had is in setting the title. You know, this board definitively talked about how the criminal conduct applies to very specifically the group of people that it applies to, all employees. But with reference to the civil conduct, we just stated that it applies to agents. I think people will be confused about that, first of all, that they won't understand the difference between agents and a very specific set of people that it applies to in the criminal context. Secondly, it refers to, in the civil context, that you can be charged based on criminal conduct. I think criminal conduct is a catchphrase, a slogan, and I also think it, again, doesn't capture all the civil aspects of this statute and the different ways you can be sued, not just for, you know, garden variety criminal conduct, but for violating civil wrongs, tortious conduct, you know, failure to warn, being aware that there's some violation in a company and not reporting it. These are new civil things. They're not necessarily criminal, but I think the title is misleading insofar that the voters are going to be surprised that it encompasses these things. And ultimately, it fails to express the true meaning and intent of the proposed initiative because it doesn't adequately apprise the voters of the extent and effect of these initiatives' reach. And it really is sweeping reform here that we're talking about, a very separate and distinct reform in both the criminal context and a civil context. We believe that another issue is that the proponents amended both the title and, more importantly, the text, I think, without having this reviewed by legislative legal services and legislative counsel, that there were substantive titles, substantive changes to the definition of who this applied to. It was associated persons, which was a much narrower group of individuals, and then this got expanded to include basically all employees of the company. The purpose is to allow legislative counsel kind of analyze and legal services, analyze these measures, look at them, comment on them, And also to allow the public to understand these at an early stage, and that didn't happen. And I think for those reasons, it needs to be sent back as well. So I will limit my comments. I think we've pretty thoroughly discussed our position with respect to this issue in the motion, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Are there any questions for Mr. Friednesh? Mr. Domenico.
Could you just clarify what you meant by that this brings in a bunch of civil conduct that's civil and not just criminal conduct? I mean,
sure.
Go ahead.
When we were here last week, counsel for the proponents pointed out this applies, this is intended to apply to the passive act of knowing and not doing anything, or extending, or not performing an act required by law. As I read the definitions, under the current definition of criminal liability of business entities, I believe it includes any type of duty that is owed. I think it includes, and I think he's articulated it as such anyway, but not performing an act required by law. I mean, you have required by law in the employment context, by way of example, duties of good faith and fair dealing, duty of loyalty, duty of fidelity to your company. Those are all civil issues that are required by law. There's also fraud issues as well that can be created in kind of a civil context. I think that's the extension of this.
But
it applies in a civil context because in here it discusses how the civil component is based on that same type of conduct that's illuminated in 1A and 1B.
Even it, I agree with you that 1A is kind of a confusing about exactly what it includes, but that's already part of the statute, right? The measure isn't changing that. So to the extent certain conduct that you or I might not consider criminal is made criminal, that's done by the current statute. What they're changing here is who can be held liable for that, right? And then what the penalties are by extending civil penalties, right? I mean, they're not changing the type of conduct that is brought within it, or are they? I mean, maybe I should ask Mr. Gruskin this, but would the extension of this to individuals change the range of conduct, I guess, is kind of what I'm asking.
And I think the answer is yes. It effectively changes things because corporations, businesses, may owe different duties and obligations under law than officers and directors to their shareholders, to board members, to their employees, or employees may hold with respect to each other and obligations they have to the company. So I think it does open Pandora's box in that context. And that's one of the problems with it. And if I'm wrong, then this is just confusing. Because to me, the plain language of this, which is confusing, you're right, it is in the law, but when you start applying it to new, separate, and distinct situations and people, you're opening up new areas and new substantive issues and new substantive crimes and new civil claims for relief.
It does say in 1A that the duty that we're talking about is one imposed on the business entity. And so I guess I would read that as not extending to kind of the separate duties that officers and have, such as like an individual fiduciary duty. But do you disagree with that?
I do, only in the sense that in litigating these kind of cases, from a civil perspective, duties employed that apply to businesses also apply to their employees. So it does create separate and distinct issues that fall within the purview of duties owned to business entities in and of themselves. If a business owes a particular duty to warn, to acknowledge pollution, for example, or to deal with pollution and not pollute, That extends to all the employees. And maybe within that construct, the employees have separate and distinct obligations with respect to that particular duty. Somebody opens a newspaper, and they believe that they read about X corporation dumped pollution in a stream, and they live near that stream, or maybe they don't. They just want to file an action, and they file a lawsuit, and they can name every employee in that company, and this will be sorted out later.
That's all I have.
Mr. Carton.
Mr. Friednesh, I just wanted to follow up on a couple of your arguments. And the first one, or well, one of them is, goes to the language, or the amendment to 18.1606, subsection 1, which says, as amended by the measure, a business entity agent or managerial agent are guilty of an offense if. And as I understand your argument, it's part of your brief, your motion going to resubmittal. It was a change made post review and comment. But as I understand your argument, you're arguing that ought to read either a business entity agent or high managerial agent is, rather than are, guilty of an offense if, or a business entity agent and high managerial agent is guilty of an offense if. And I didn't pick this up the first time the measure was through, but the word is in that introductory paragraph and does not appear stricken. And I got to confess that as it's written, I'm a little confused as to what it means as well, but could you maybe just touch on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I can do a better job than what you just did. Okay. I mean, that's the problem I have isolated. And it's, I don't think I can be any more articulate than that explanation, or if you set it up.
And then the second question that I have, just to follow up on, I think your argument in paragraph 3, paragraph A, where you mentioned this, that the variance implies more of a civil component. This goes to the actual title of the measure, where the title currently says, in the trailer specifically, following in connection therewith, extending criminal liability to a business entity's directors, officers, and employees and agents who formulate a business's policies or supervise employees, and then going down to allowing any Colorado resident to bring an action for civil damages against a business or its agent for such criminal conduct. Is your argument basically that in that second clause, the one that begins allowing any Colorado resident, that instead of just having against a business or its agent, that language ought to conform to the language in the first clause following the in connection therewith? In other words, is it your argument that it ought to read consistent with the measure, allowing any Colorado resident to bring an action for civil damages against a business entity's directors, officers, and employees and agents who formulate a business's policies or supervise employees?
Yeah, that's part of it. And the reason being, I think the inconsistency may confuse voters or mislead them to think that it applies to a class of people they may not understand. I don't know. I don't think voters understand what the term agent means. And I think that's why you have a definition in the statute that explains who the agents are. And let me point out one other thing. As you just read that, as a voter is going to read this, they're going to read this to read that it extends criminal liability to business entities, directors, officers, and employees and agents who formulate a business policies or supervise employees. That seems to suggest that this initiative only applies to those employees who formulate policies or supervise employees, and that's not what it does, and that's another problem. As you read that, just as it's drafted today, it does not clearly delineate that you don't have to just supervise employees or formulate business policies to have this apply to you. So I think that's a second problem within that.
I guess I'd just say I disagree with that, and I think we specifically addressed that issue at the last meeting, and that's why it's okay. Crafted that way. So
I understand.
Formulating a business policy applies just to the right. To the agents.
But my concern is voter confusion. Somebody reading this could easily jump and believe that that only applies to those people that fall within that class of categories, and I think it goes beyond that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none, then thank you.
Can I make just one other point in passing?
Yes.
You asked as to A and whether that just applies to businesses. I think the way B's written, it also raises all these different issues of those different duties applying. So they talk about acting within the scope of their employment. I think that kind of raises it in that phrase as well. That's all I have.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
I'd like to hear next from Mark Gruskin on behalf of proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Mr. Friednesh and I informally agreed out in the hall that we would try not to make this a marathon session, so I'll keep my comments brief. The single subject argument is basically that there is an expanded criminal liability and there are private rights of action resulting in potential civil actions. I would suggest that if the criminal-civil dichotomy becomes the basis for a decision about single subject, that there are a number of statutes that are suspect. And I haven't done an exhaustive review, but I will tell you that, for instance, the antitrust statutes authorize the Attorney General to institute criminal proceedings. Passed in 1992 as part of the same law, there was, and that authority exists at 6-4-117 CRS. In the same law at the same time, passed by the same General Assembly in the same act, the General Assembly provided for civil damages in 6-4-114 CRS. Now, was that a violation of single subject, providing civil and criminal penalties in the same act? Well, if so, then in 2003, when the General Assembly passed a statute requiring prompt payment of wages to employers, it established at 8-4-114 certain criminal penalties. And likewise, at 8-4-119, provided for certain civil penalties, all in the same act, all in 2003. Additionally, in 1990, the General Assembly passed a securities rewrite and provided for both criminal and civil penalties in 11-51-603 and 604. I could go on and on, but you get the flavor of where I'm going. I think that the Supreme Court has consistently said that enforcement is a subtopic of the more general subject and does not in itself reflect a second subject. So if you've got two means of enforcement, civil and criminal, do you have a multiple subject? I'd suggest to you that the Supreme Court has never looked at it that way. It's looked at initiatives that have civil and criminal remedies and found that they reflect single subjects. The suggestion is that this is a sweeping change. And in fact, what this is it's an extremely narrow change. As the Legislative Council and Office of Legislative Legal Services pointed out at our opponents' review and comment hearing, and what I'd like to do, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is provide you with a copy of that.
Thank you.
Now we need to find my copy of that memo. On page 3, question 4A, they wanted to know why in the original draft there was a definition of an associated person and asked how that compared with 18-1-607, that describes criminal liability of an individual for corporate conduct. There is already an affirmative legislative act that imposes individual liability for criminal acts of a corporation. All this statute does is say where the corporation or the entity knows of affirmative obligations under law and does nothing, in other words, an omission rather than a commission, there is also liability. This is a gap filler. And so the sweeping liability that is suggested, in fact, already potentially exists, and therefore the unknown potential, I think, is not entirely accurate. The suggestion is that the statement of the single subject is inaccurate, the liability for criminal conduct of businesses. And ultimately, we get back to the issue that this really is about the business entity's conduct and what a specific individual associated with that entity does or doesn't do. And so it ultimately is, in fact, all rooted back to the business entity. Now, we could tweak that, and I frankly wouldn't have any problem with doing so. But I think ultimately you could also leave it the same, because this is not an issue that is somehow spun off to people who are unassociated with a business. It is the business entity's criminal conduct. The suggestion is made that criminal conduct is a catchphrase. You've got to have some evidence, the Supreme Court has said, that it's a catchphrase. And obviously the word, I don't think the word conduct is problematic. So the question would be whether criminal is problematic. And if it is, I would have no problem virtually mimicking the statute, which speaks, the existing statute, which speaks of conduct. 1A talks about conduct constituting the offense, as does 1B. So if you want to talk about conduct constituting a criminal offense, you can certainly do that. As long as I'm looking at the statute, and we seem to kind of be dealing with some accuracy issues and some single subject issues, rather than leave anything unaddressed, I thought we'd just kind of make it global here. I think it's important to note that the allegation that there are all sorts of internal corporate standards of conduct that are implicated is pretty much belied by the first sentence in one that talks about an entity or agent is guilty of an offense if. You can't be guilty of anything other than a crime, at least to the best of my knowledge. This is being done under the criminal statutes. Therefore, I don't think there's any real problem with the expansion to some fiduciary responsibility or other civil issue, unless you can be guilty of a civil offense, which is not how that word is typically used, nor is it how it's typically understood, nor is it how it's specifically used here in this statute. Likewise, the offense language is replicated not only in the first line, but in subparagraph A and subparagraph B. So there has to be an offense under the criminal code. And so I think that the expanse really is not nearly as broad as would be suggested. The other jurisdictional issue that is raised is that the proponents made a substantive change without giving the legislative council an opportunity to consider it, that being the expansion of the language to expansion of the language to agent. But I would point out for you at the top of page 4 on the review and comment memo that I've handed out that the specific question that was raised by staff was, quote, what is the difference between the definition of associated person and agent in section 18.1606 Colorado Revised Statute? So the parallel or lack of parallel or the overlap or the inconsistency between the definition that was proposed and the existing statutory definition was raised by staff in the review and comment hearing. That they didn't suggest specific language doesn't mean that they didn't bring up the definition of agent, of which high managerial agent is part. I would note for you that paragraph 2A in the existing statute is a combined definition. And therefore, the fact that the proponents decided not to create their own definition in this measure, but to use the definition that is already provided by statute, was at the direct suggestion of the staff. This last issue about how the language was chosen in terms of a business entity agent or high managerial agent are guilty of an offense if, also stems from the staff's specific suggestion. On page 2 at the bottom, question number 5, the original language was that a business entity and associated person is guilty. And the proponent's grammar was called into question, and the suggestion was made that are should be used instead of is. Now, perhaps that was a mistake on the part of the proponents based upon the suggestion of staff, but it was based upon the suggestion of staff. And therefore, it didn't spring from the brow of Zeus or even from the brow of the proponents. It came directly from the review and comment process. Without getting into specific possible language changes, I think that covers the jurisdictional arguments. And if I've missed something, I'm happy to respond to your questions and thoughts.
Questions for Mr. Gruskin? Mr. Domenico.
I just have a couple of quick ones. First, what does high managerial agent do in this? I mean, doesn't everything that applies to, I mean, as you said, high managerial agent to me is a subset of agent or employee, or it's a subset of something else that's defined in there, and all the penalties and all the provisions apply equally to everyone. Is there something I'm missing that there's a reason there's a high managerial agent is in there at all?
Are you asking about in the original statute or in the proposed?
Yeah, or either. I mean, are there cross references to that elsewhere in the statutes that?
To be honest with you, Mr. Domenico, I haven't gone back and listened to the legislative tapes. My guess is that that was some really good idea that sprang out of a legislative committee hearing or perhaps a debate. But I've looked at the statute to see if there's different treatment of an agent as opposed to a high managerial agent.
There's
not. I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Now, the proponents included both terms just to make it clear that there wasn't a conflict, that there wasn't some sort of carve-out. Whether that was warranted or whether they could have just used agent,
right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I just find that confusing because when you read that, you think, oh, well, there's going to be some reason you treat a high managerial agent differently than a regular employee. I don't see it anywhere.
I suppose, I mean, obviously there is overlap because officers are both agents and high managerial agents.
Mm-hmm.
What is not overlap is any other agent in a position of comparable authority with respect to formulation of business policy. So I don't know. I suppose then, because it uses the word agent, it must be limited to directors and employees, as well as officers, that have that kind of role, rather than, as suggested, independent contractors or consultants. Or I assume that the legislature meant to use the word that it did in referring back. So I just
wonder if there was at one time a differential treatment of the two, because there's not.
I'm afraid I really don't have
all right.
your answer for you.
Okay. My other question was, when you were talking about what an offense is, you suggested that it's only an offense if it's, and maybe I'm misreading you, only an offense if it's somehow otherwise an offense in the criminal code, but the way I read it is this makes an offense subject to the criminal penalties, and now under your proposal, civil penalties, makes a criminal offense. Anything that is an omission to discharge a specific duty of affirmative performance imposed on the business entity by law, which seems to me not to require some other criminal prohibition, just a specific duty imposed on the entity by law, becomes, by nature of the current statute, a criminal offense, right? And then the two things that I see this measure as doing is making individuals responsible for that and then also including this civil aspect. But I don't see that that the current statute requires that it somewhere else be defined as a crime. Am I wrong about that?
Rephrase that last.
Well, you suggested, and maybe I just misheard, that the only things that amount to offenses under current law, and will also, which this doesn't change, according as I think you're saying, under current law, I thought you suggested that there had to be some. It's only an offense under this statute if it's an offense under some other criminal prohibition. And my reading of it is this creates the criminal prohibition, even if the other duty that's imposed is not necessarily couched as criminal. I mean, I think there are, the example we used last time was requirements, disposal requirements for pollution, which themselves don't impose criminal, aren't, those statutes don't necessarily say it's a crime if you don't dispose of it. They just say you shall dispose of your hazardous waste in a certain way. And my reading of this is, of the current statute is, if you fail to do that, the entity is then guilty of a crime as it's laid out in this section. Is your understanding different, that it has to be a crime separately from this section? That the disposal statute would have to say it's a criminal offense not to do this?
I think there are two answers to your question. The broad one that certainly was the basis for my earlier statement is reflected by what legislative staff told the proponents. On page 3, question number 4, staff stated, quote, section 18.1.606, common revised statutes, describes the circumstance under which a business may be guilty of an offense. It is not an offense itself. Now, presuming staff to be, you know, accurate and credible, I take that at its face value, and therefore would suggest to you that when the proponents expanded the applicability of that precept, that it describes the circumstance under which guilt can be found rather than a specific offense, that they were accurate. I would also suggest to you that paragraph 3 talks about where businesses commit offenses which, if committed by an individual, would result in the following punishment. So I think what sub 3 does is to take, to meet your issue, it current law already applies statutes to corporations, even if corporations are not specifically referred to. And this measure doesn't change that at all. I don't know if that was helpful to you, but I think that, as a general matter, I think that the staff's suggestion is correct, that this doesn't create specific offenses. It creates circumstances under which an offense may be deemed to occur.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it matters to me, but I'm also not sure that I agreed with the legislative staff interpretation. So maybe I at least ought to pause here and try to figure out if it's relevant to this discussion. I mean, it looks to me like 606 does define an offense and impose penalties. I mean, the existing law. I didn't bring 607 with me, but I interpreted 607 to mean that that when an individual does something wrong, they can't say, as long as it was in their official capacity for the corporation or the business, that they're protected from prosecution. In other words, if they did commit a crime that can be independently prosecuted against the individual, then the fact that they did it in their official capacity, so to speak, was basically no defense. Which seems to be a little different than the legislative interpretation, because it does look to me like 606 really does define a crime and impose a penalty on a business for business misconduct. And then the measure extends that crime to individuals, agents and high managerial agents under some circumstances. So I don't know. I'm just not sure that this goes anywhere, but I just wanted to point out I wasn't quite sure that I saw the legislative staff interpretation quite the same way. Now, they know better than me, but I just didn't see it the same way. But.
Well, I'd like to defer to them, too. I think that the title of Section 606 is criminal liability of businesses. It's not about establishing new crimes. And I think certainly in the Tabor context, the Supreme Court has looked to the title as indicative of the of constraints to be implied upon a proposal that's presented to the voters. And I think that, you know, in the same context, this measure would be applied. But I agree with you in it may be a distinction without a difference here in terms of describing liability that is attributable to individuals under specific circumstances.
Mr. Cardin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, I tend to agree with Mr. Hobbs about with regard to the fact that this appears to be a statute that sets forth an offense and a penalty. But I just want to make sure that I understand. And I would say, this is probably an editorial comment, the statute is currently written probably as artful as it could be. But the way that I read it, and I know that time is of the essence here, but under current law, under 18.1606, under subsection 1, a business entity is guilty of an offense if either of the conditions in 1A or 1B are met. And when you go down to subsection 3, there's some language that talks about corporations.
Right.
And then you get to the language that says, for an offense committed on or after July 1, 2003, a business entity shall be subject to the payment of a fine. And then an offense committed by a business entity that would be a misdemeanor, et cetera. And so, to me, you have the offenses set forth in 1A and 1B, and you have the penalty set forth in subsection 3. I went back and looked, and this statute was amended in 2003. And basically, what they did was everywhere where it said corporation, they inserted business entity and then created a definition of business entity. And the language for in subsection 3, for an offense committed on or after July 1, 2003, was added in 2003. And if you, I'm sure you know all that, Mr. Gruskin, but I just wanted to get that as part of this discussion. And so that's how I interpret the statute now. With the amendment, the difficulty that I'm having, and I recognize what the staff memo says in question number 5 there on page 2. And when the measure was submitted, the language said business entity and associated person is guilty. And the question was, and the comment was, if the proponents intended to use the and, then the is should change to are. Or if the proponents intend to use is, then it should be business entity or associated person. And what happened, I think, was that they went ahead and did the or, but did the are too. Didn't leave the is in. That sounds a little bit like Dr. Seuss, but I think that's the issue here. Is that the way I read it now? Is a business entity, agent, or high managerial agent are guilty of an offense if, and assuming for the sake of discussion that the R should be an is. When you get to A, the conduct constituting the offense consists of an omission to discharge a specific duty of affirmative performance imposed on the business entity by law. If it's entity, agent, or high managerial agent, does this impose liability? And this may get to Mr. Domenico's line of question. I'm not, and if it does, I apologize. But assuming it's entity, agent, or high managerial agent is, if the conduct constituting the offense consists of an omission to discharge, a specific duty of affirmative performance imposed on the business entity by the law. Is the business entity, the agent, and the high managerial agent all guilty of the offense? Because there's no conforming language to 1A or 1B, for example, and I think we went over this last time, to say in 1A, for example, imposed on the business entity, agent, or high managerial agent. And so my question is, if there's a violation of 1A, who's guilty?
The way the measure reads, the individuals who are covered under the statute and the business entity are potentially guilty. Obviously, I can't tell you, based upon facts that are unknown to me, whether or not all would be guilty. It might be one, it might be two, it might be three. It depends upon...
But what would limit that? Well, I mean, the only defense I see, I mean, the way it's written is that they're all guilty if the business, I mean, and that means every employee, and there's no limit on them knowing that any of this. They're all guilty if the entity engaged in this, and their only affirmative defense, as it's written, is that they reported it to the Attorney General. I mean, are you relying on some kind of due process exception that would be read into this that would limit it to actual individuals who had some responsibility for it? Because there's not in the plain language of it.
Well, the plain language is what the plain language is. And frankly, you know, I mean, I don't know that this goes to single subject as much as it goes to kind of the merits of the measure.
Right. Yeah, and I appreciate that. I just want to make sure we understand what's going on. But that is the way I read it, that the statute itself wouldn't contain any kind of a knowledge requirement or a responsibility requirement on the part of an agent. So the plain language would include every employee is guilty of a crime under this. And I don't know, maybe you're right that's not really our problem. But
the question seems to me is whether or not your current language in describing that is accurate. And
right
now your current language says extending criminal liability to a business entity's directors, officers, and employees, and then this clause about agents, if the business fails to perform duties that are required by law or if management engages in blah, 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 blah. Your title reflects your reading of the measure.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that. I think I agree that that's not really our problem. I'm not sure I agree that the title is as clear as it could be, but I just wanted to make sure because I was struggling with trying to figure out who's guilty, and it seems to me that under the statute itself, it's everybody. And now maybe it would be interpreted in a way to alleviate the sort of absurd situation where you'd have every employee guilty of a crime. I mean, I would hope so, but...
Well, and there's nothing in here, as you point out, that reads out due process from the Colorado Constitution.
Sure.
So, I mean, would a campaign be run that suggests certain things? Sure. Is this the only draft of the measure that you're going to see this cycle? I don't know. But my guess is that for purposes of today, the issue is whether or not, whether this is a proposal you can substantively get your arms around in terms of embracing, whether or not the title is accurate. And then the proponents are going to figure out which measure of theirs to circulate. And frankly, let me take one step away. One of the real criticisms of the initiative process is that there's no give and take, and therefore things get floated to voters that are truly problematic. My view is that, notwithstanding maybe the legislative staff didn't quite get it right in terms of their comments, that's one opportunity for that kind of review. The first hearing before this board is a second opportunity for that review. Thoughtful comments made by knowledgeable counsel are another opportunity for that review. A rehearing is a fourth opportunity. This is a productive exercise. And so, you know, I just want you to know that I appreciate the give and take. And, you know, I'm serious when I tell you this may not be the only version of this measure that you'll see.
All right. Can I just ask, could you just explain a little bit more how you see this as interacting with 18.1607?
Sure. 18.1607 provides that the affirmative criminal acts of a corporation are attributable to certain of its key actors. What it does not say is that the failure to act is attributable to certain of its key actors. This measure is intended to fill in that gap so that there is liability for commission and omission on the part of both the entity and its key actors.
Any other questions for Mr. Gruskin? Okay, thank you. Mr. Friednash, any final comments?
Just real brief.
Okay. I would tell you that whether the General Assembly passes something or not, and whether that constitutes single subject, is no real standard for a title board dealing with initiative process. I can think of many things that passed while serving the legislature that probably didn't fall within the scope of a single subject. Having said that, enforcement's not just what this is about. This is about it creates new substantive crimes. And clearly, this is an offense and a penalty. The word offense starts in subsection 1. They're guilty of an offense if, and then defines the type of offenses they are dealing with here. And it is something that whether DAs or Attorney General's office prosecutes cases, persons will be filing cases based on this. People will read this and believe they have a private right of action based on this type of conduct. And I think that is something that we will see. And I think it is confusing. And ultimately, you know, there are hidden purposes here. And, you know, it is, there are a lot of provisions here that are coiled up in the folds of a complex initiative. Now, it's easy to say this is just business liability, but it's confusing, it's misleading, it's hard to read, and the voters are going to be surprised by the manner in which it is ultimately interpreted. You know, when we were here previously, Mr. Gruskin explained this as what this statute deals with is either the passive act of knowing but not doing anything about it, or in the alternative, not performing the duties required by law. This is an expansion here. It's not just about enforcement of other criminal acts. Thank you.
I have one more question that I think maybe is more for Mr. Gruskin, but you might be able to answer it while you're up there. And that is there any similar civil right of action under 607 or the affirmative, the imposition of this affirmative crime for affirmative act? Is there a similar civil liability section in that, or is that unique to this new measure? Like in 607, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of. I'll defer to Mark, but not that I'm aware of.
No, I mean, that's my recollection. 7 is
straight criminal.
Line, straight,
yeah,
criminal.
That's my recollection, too. Okay.
I don't have anyone else left to testify, so I will turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board?
I guess I'll start. This is a closer case than the last one, but I'm still where I was previously in thinking that this is two subjects. I think the cases that I looked at that sort of were relevant are the Waters cases, the number 17 from last year about the environmental conservation as well as a public trust doctrine, and then number 55. All of those, it's quite clear to me, could be grouped under something you would call a single subject. But yet the court held all of them to violate the single subject requirement, and the only way I can try to make sense of these, and I'm not sure I've ever succeeded, is that if you have to raise the level of generality of what you call the subject so high that it's pretty far removed from the actual action that's going on in the measure, in order to bring everything under it, which is to say, I picture kind of a pyramid, and the subject is way up high, and the two things, they're really here to me, are the only two things that trouble me, and they seem, while they're related to the same single subject, they're sort of surprising, and I think not really connected to each other in any sort of necessary way, and that is the extension, as Mr. Gruskin said, the basic point here is extending liability to individuals for omissions of their corporation. That seems to me to be one subject. And then the imposition, though, of these new civil penalties, both on the business and on the individuals, is, I think, sort of confusing. The fact that there's a separate statute that already imposes some criminal liability on individuals adds to what I think is kind of confusion here, that I would think that the clearer way to do, the way that would be less surprising, less of a risk of kind of log rolling, of hiding this expansion of civil liability behind the sort of the basic what I see as the basic purpose, which is to extend liability for omissions to individuals, corporate or business entity omissions to individuals, would be to either do the extension of liability for individuals in 807, which already deals with that subject, and then separately in 607, and this is 606. And then if you want to expand the types of remedies that are available or the types of enforcement to include civil penalties, you could do that in here in 606. Trying to do the two of them together, as opposed to some of the legislation that Mr. Gruskin referenced, where you create a new crime and you say, well, the way we're going to enforce this is going to include both civil and criminal penalties. I think there's something very different about this, where basically you're saying, well, we've already got these crimes, we're extending liability for them to individuals, and we're also creating a new form of enforcement. For some reason, to me, I find that much more of a surprise and unrelated to the basic point of who should be liable, of how they should be liable. And maybe I'm wrong about that. I would also point out, we're probably not supposed to say it out loud, but I think it's pretty clear that the single subject requirement is applied more stringently to initiatives than it is to everyday legislation, whether that's wise or not. I think my reading of especially the water cases 17 and 55 suggests that while these are related to a single subject, the what they do under that single subject is so unrelated to each other that I don't think we can really accurately capture it in the title, which suggests to me that it's not a single subject.
Garten, or okay. I'll go ahead and start. I guess I do see it a little differently than Mr. Domenico, I think. I'm sort of wondering if Mr. Carton is going to say something that turns me around, but basically I think I don't see this as a single subject violation. And I agree that it's sometimes hard to when we look at cases like public rights and water and others, sometimes it's hard to and number 55. Sometimes hard to figure out what the rules of the game are, but I think this is a fairly narrow subject, not an excessively broad subject. I think it does have to do with liability for business misconduct, which I think is a fairly well-confined subject. There's more than one thing going on in the measure to advance the purposes of the measure, I think, and as Mr. Domenico and Mr. Domenico notes what they are, but it seems to me that they are all related to business liability for misconduct and extending liability to individuals seems to promote that purpose that the proponents have, as well as providing award of civil penalties as well. So I see them as pretty tightly connected to the purpose and within a fairly narrow subject, I think. So I just see it a little differently, I think. So. Any comments, Mr. Carton?
I don't have much to add to your comments, Mr. Chairman. I too, based on the text of the measure, if there are two purposes here, if there are more than one purpose, they're certainly related in my mind, and the fact that you have extension of criminal liability to a business's agents coupled with a civil right of action against the entity or its agents arising out of that criminal activity, those are interrelated purposes. That doesn't rise to the level of, as the court has said, grouping distinct purposes where the connection is too broad and too general to make them part of the same subject. Or in 55, where the court said that complexity and omnibus provisions are hidden from the voter. You don't have that here. There's no surprise in my mind, and I'm reluctant to even go to the surprise analysis, but I would just say that, to me, it seems as though it's a fairly narrow title and or subject, and that there is a single subject. And I think that when you do have decisions like, I think Mr. Domenico's point is well taken, that when you have articulations of the single subject requirement and looking and where the court says in one paragraph that they're not going to look at the effect or the intent of the measure, or construe the legal effects, and then go straight to, we must examine sufficiently an initiative central theme as to express to determine whether it contains incongruous or hidden purposes or bundles incongruous measures under a broad theme. That makes it tough on the title board. And so what I come back to, I guess, is 140.106.5, and to Mr. Domenico's comment about more of a stringent view of the single subject on initiatives than is before the General Assembly on bills, one take on it, but I'm reluctant to go there, and I just come back to kind of keep my eye on the ball under 140.106.5 subsection 3, where it says, it is further the intent of the General Assembly that in setting titles pursuant to section 1.5.5 of Article 5, the initiative title setting review board created in section 140.106 should apply judicial decisions constraining the constitutional single subject requirement for bills and should follow the same rules employed by the General Assembly in considering titles for bills. And I think that Mr. Gruskin's pointing out a couple of statutes that have done where you've had a civil and a criminal component in both provide a strong basis for a conclusion that this has a single subject. And I'm still kind of following that as part of my pulsar. To me, in my mind, there's a single subject here if there's a bill, and so I'm going to go ahead and extend that to an initiative.
Just respond real quickly on that last point. I mean, my point about the cases cited by Mr. Gruskin is the more important point to me is not having really looked at all of them, the way they were characterized, and my understanding of them is that I wouldn't necessarily disagree that with those. I don't think, though, that they're analogous. I mean, saying X is now a crime, and we are going to enforce this crime through both civil and criminal penalties, is different to me than saying this thing that's a crime, we're now holding responsible for it a whole new class of people, and in addition, both for those new people and for the entity that previously was responsible for it, we're creating a new type of liability. To me, is very different than saying we are creating a new type of wrongful conduct and here's how we're going to enforce it. And I agree that these can be related to a single subject. I find, frankly, liability for criminal conduct of businesses, though, is very broad, contrary to Mr. Hobbs's statement. This doesn't define any of that conduct. You have to look elsewhere for it. And so, I mean, the combination of adding a new type of liability to an existing crime, as well as adding a new class of people who are subject to prosecution and to the new type of liability, is where I have the trouble and where I see a distinction that's very different from the cases we were talking about, even whether or not they're initiatives or legislation.
Thank you. I guess I'll go ahead and move that that the board deny the motion for rehearing.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1, and that completes action on number 57. The time is 12:07 p.m. Let's go on to the next agenda item, 2007-2008, number 62, cause for employees. Mr. Gruskin, yes, sir.
Did your ruling, just so I understand, did your ruling cover the various points, the allegations made about the inherent lack of clarity? Did you interpret those to be, and I'm not sure, I wasn't sure about whether those were challenges to the jurisdiction of the board or whether those were challenges to the title you set, as was the case for the specific allegation on, you know, who's an agent and whether or not the single subject reference is correct. So I just want to make sure that the ruling is clear on the record.
Okay, thank you. And although I didn't speak to that, it was my intention to also support what the board had done before with respect to the titles and so forth, including the questions about whether the changes were in response to comments from legislative staff and so forth. I don't know whether the other board members want to weigh in on that.
Well, I'll just say I think the title is confusing and misleading in some ways, but it's related to the fact that I think the measure itself contains more than one subject. So,
thank you. So again, we'll close the discussion then on number 57 and go on to number 62. And in the interest of time, we're actually going to have to move a little faster on this one. I think we have to be by about 12:45. I'd like to be finished. Again, we have a motion for rehearing with a fine brief from Mr. Friednash. Would you like to highlight some of your points, please?
Let me make this quick as well. I appreciate your time constraint. This is a complex initiative with a very broad theme that contains a lot of hidden purposes and bundles incongruous measures under that very broad thing. Let me just kind of highlight what is missing and what this does. The intent and purposes of this is to eliminate at-will employment doctrine in Colorado. That is nowhere contained in the measure itself or the text. It eliminates the party's right to enter into employment contracts, collective bargaining agreements.
It's a hidden purpose. That is one of the things this does. It's not addressed in the text or the title. It replaces that traditional employment relationship with a new just cause standard that governs all employment relationships in Colorado, public and private. I believe the voters are going to be surprised to understand that, again, this eliminates at-will employment, that, two, it creates a just cause standard to the extent there were there is one, and that the just cause standard includes, and I will concede that this is included in the title itself, but there are non-business or non-performance reasons that constitute the termination of just cause. They can be a reduction in force by a business of less than 10% would not constitute just cause. So it goes beyond the traditional concept of just cause. But I think in doing so, that will be confusing for voters to understand. It creates a, and here's where I think it really goes beyond into another subject, and really an incongruous subject in that, is this isn't just about creating a new standard for the termination of employees or suspension of employees, which is largely hidden, that we are actually replacing the current one, but it also creates this new remedy. And the new remedy is for a sole remedy for dispute resolution, which is called mediation, but it's a final binding decision. It's not a non-binding mediation that we're all familiar with, which would be arbitration. And again, this is placed in the Constitution. It's not something the legislature is going to be able to tinker except to the level to which they can facilitate the implementation of this. But this is going to be placed in the Constitution, and the sole remedy is for someone to file a complaint within 30 days and to have a hearing in 120 days. That's not in the bill title, those two pieces, this complaint procedure, that it's a final decision is not clear. Nor is it clear, a hidden purpose, that this now goes along and eliminates one's right to the court system. You may agree to disagree on it, but that's my interpretation of this. And if I'm wrong, then it's just confusing and misleading to voters. But I think voters will be surprised that this is the effect of this proceeding. There is no, unlike the Arbitration Act, which lays out in a number of different statutes, the method of which you can appeal to district court and the basis of which you can appeal, there's no such reference here whatsoever. Instead, it just says that this is a final decision. It eliminates access to court, due process, and personnel system rights that are available to state employees. Again, voters are going to be surprised to learn that if you're a state employee, that there's this new mechanism that has been created here. It is a separate and distinct purpose and subpart, and subject matter, not even a subpart, but the impact that this initiative creates. It creates new remedies that aren't provided by law. One is attorney's fees provision. There is an attorney's fees provision under the Wage Claim Act, by way of example only, but not with respect to traditional employment relationships or contract relationships, unless it is a part of the contract itself. But this allows a new remedy, which is attorney's fees, and another new remedy, which is reinstatement. There's no remedy right now in Colorado law that provides for reinstatement except in Title VII context. So ultimately, what this does is it joins multiple subjects and poses a danger of unfair surprise and fraud occasioned by the inadvertent passage of a surreptitious provision, coiled up in the fields of a complex initiative. This is from the decision last year in Initiative 17. And as Mr. Cardin recently pointed out, what's difficult is there's clear language that says in that decision you have to examine sufficiently an initiative's central theme to determine whether it contains hidden purposes under a broad theme. This clearly contains hidden purposes under a very broad theme of just cause for termination and suspension of employees. I think it is similar to NRA proposed initiative 1997 through 1998, number 63, where the court held that the title board failed by fixing a title and summary of initiative and title judicial qualifications because it contained provisions proposing to change the manner of the selection, powers, and procedures of an independent constitutional body, which were unrelated to judicial qualifications. The theme was the judicial branch, but could not be considered to be a single subject. It's easy to say we have this single subject and everything fits within the scope of it. But the problem here is that, one, it doesn't, and two, voters are going to really be surprised of all the direct implications of what this initiative does. It conflicts with the Constitution. Granted, yeah, you don't have to go to the merits right now, but as we've learned from Amendment 41, you know, it takes years, potentially, to unravel some of the mysteries of initiatives, especially when they get placed in the Colorado Constitution. It may take years to unravel this. And how a court interprets conflicting constitutional amendments or provisions and the manner in which they do it is going to be an issue. And it is, at a minimum, confusing and misleading. But in my view, it goes a step further because that's actually what this does. The use of the phrase mediation and finality are really misleading terms in this document and things that I think are going to be very confusing to the voter. And then finally, let me just touch on, again, a similar problem that occurs here that occurred in the last measure, which is the amended title and text wasn't exactly, well, first of all, the amended title was submitted here. The text itself added two new definitions to just cause, which, again, it's my understanding that those two issues, which were the filing of bankruptcy by a business and the simultaneous discharge of 10% or more employer's workforce in Colorado, were provisions that weren't contemplated by legislative counsel and legal services. So, as promised, I made my remarks brief and we'll take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Gruskin.
Okay. Let's see who can be briefer. Most of the concerns raised are about what voters might or might not understand as to the potential effects. First of all of that is conjecture. Secondly, the court has never said that the effects of a measure have to be stated in the title. And thirdly, that's the purpose of a campaign. I mean, that's why campaign professionals use the maxim for voters, if you don't know, vote no. And I'm sure that there will be an active campaign on this. But the question is whether or not this is a single subject. I think that our position was stated at the initial hearing. I'm not going to go through it again. Bottom line, you've got concerns about potential effects rather than actual distinct purposes that have no reasonable connection with one another. And that alone is not a basis for this board not to set a title. In addition, as to the civil service system and the like, the court traditionally reads these provisions consistent with existing law, and I think they do that here. The question was also raised as to, in terms of jurisdictional concerns, whether or not the additional conditions of just cause were ever considered by the Legislative Council and Legislative Legal Services. Commission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to the review comment memo.
Thank you.
I'd ask you to take a look at page 5, question number 5, at which point the staff specifically raised whether or not the proponents were intending to require that just cause be applied even when there was, quote, a lack of work or even bankruptcy of the employer. Is this the proponent's intent? Proponents took heed of that question and added those two conditions. Obviously, they added some specificity so that it wasn't simply that vague language, and therefore, we think the issue was adequately addressed below. I think all the other issues were addressed 2 weeks ago, so I'm not going to repeat our responses unless you want me to.
One question is, would it be a fair statement that the purpose of the initiative is to eliminate the at-will employment doctrine in Colorado?
Well, I think that you've got it more accurately done in terms of your single subject statement, which talks about, and doesn't say established, but it's the establishment of a just cause standard for actions. Obviously, oh, that stands in distinction to the at-will status or standard that is currently used.
Okay.
But it isn't simply eliminating at-will, because that would leave a void.
Okay. Thank you.
I got one quick thing. The one thing that concerns me is this, is the mediation. And I think we talked about last time, I think you sort of reassured me that just because it says it's final doesn't mean there's no recourse to the courts after that. And if that's true, I think I'm willing to go along. I think it would trouble me if, especially since I think Mr. Friednash is right, that this is really arbitration that's called mediation. That by itself is probably not enough for me to find the measure misleading, but if it were combined with the idea that in addition to establishing a just cause regime, you're also taking all disputes about employment essentially out of the court system, would seem to me to be a pretty big change that was kind of hidden. And so as long as I'm assured that that's not the intent, and you won't be coming in the Supreme Court urging them to say that nobody can challenge the decision of one of these mediators, then I think I'm okay.
Mr. Domenico, as I stated 2 weeks ago, this doesn't create an exception to the right of judicial review. All this does is set an expedited time frame for an initial informal process between employer and employee, and frankly, as to finality, it is clear that it is a final decision as to the process under this subsection.
Okay. That's what I hoped you'd say.
Mr. Garten.
Mr. Gruskin, assuming for the sake of this question that I'm about to ask in for discussion, that Mr. Friednash's allegations that the true purpose is, assuming for the sake of the discussion that the effect of the measure is to create a just cause standard for employee discharge or suspension and to supersede or repeal at-will employment in Colorado, and the effect is that it supersedes and impliedly repeals the state's civil service system, as well as impacting any local governmental civil service system that may be in place. Assuming that that's the effect, for the sake of discussion, that those are the effects of the measure, and you don't have to agree or disagree that those are, like you say, there may be conjecture, but for the sake of discussion, let's say that is the effect. Why, under the relevant cases, shouldn't separate measures be presented to the voters for each of those three, for just cause, for the impact on the civil service, state and local, and the at-will.
All right. Why shouldn't
those be treated as separate subjects?
First of all, you know, the underlying basis of my answer is that I don't concede.
The purported
effects. It seems to me that the at-will and just cause effects, if you will, or provisions, go hand in hand. I mean, you couldn't have at-will and just cause. I think that's clear. If you were making a blanket rule, you couldn't have both of those. So necessarily one is part of the other subject. I just have a very, very difficult time thinking that proponents would be required to have one initiative that terminates the at-will process and a second initiative that establishes just cause. Because if the first initiative would pass and the second wouldn't, what's the standard in Colorado? So that one I don't think really concerns me. The civil service issues, it seems to me that if what you're trying to do is create a common platform from which all employees may under which they work, and so that they have common conditions and potential circumstances of termination or suspension, then you wouldn't need to have a separate measure as to either state employees or local employees. If that level of expansiveness is what proponents desire, then it seems to me you can do that. Now, I don't think, as I said last time, that's what this does. But I don't see anything in the case law that says that you have to treat similarly situated individuals under separate ballot measures. And that's basically what you're saying. If you perform a governmental function, you are inherently different. If you're a nurse working in a public hospital, you are inherently different and therefore subject to different employment standards than a nurse working in a private hospital. Now, I'm not saying that makes good policy. I'm just saying that there's no reason why that can't be part of the same measure. And I'll add, as just in a 15-second blurb, that as I said as to number 57, this process is helpful in terms of fleshing out some of these issues, and I would doubt that this is the last measure that you see that deals with this subject, so that there is greater clarity on issues like that one. But the fact that those other measures might be out there doesn't mean that this one is out there.
Thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Friednesch, any final remarks?
Yeah, please. Thank you. Just for the record, indicate that I think both times I've spoken less than Mr. Gruzka. And I will try to again. Let me start here. Clearly, the intent of this is to, among other things, but the primary intent is to eliminate at-will employment. And Mr. Gruskin acknowledged that specifically to this board when we were here last week. It doesn't say it eliminates at-will employment, but that's the effect of it. It does eliminate at-will employment. It doesn't have to say something to actually have certain effects. And I would point out that there are other measures I think you will see. And one of those other measures tries to clean up some of these ambiguities. And one of them is it clarifies a right to appeal. It discusses the fact, kind of talks about mediation and discusses the fact there are these certain appellate rights. It goes through a number of other different pieces that are problematic under this, and those are other initiatives that will go through this process. And it also exempts out state employees and local governmental employees, recognizing that, again, that is a specific implication. It doesn't have to say something to have that effect, and that's the point of hidden purposes and hidden effects. You can't just turn a blind eye and not understand that these are the things that happen as a result of this language. It doesn't have to say it in here to have that impact, but that's what it does. The reality is this does, in fact, create certain obstacles to the court system. You can't go in and argue a separate case in the court system because the first thing that either the employer or employee is going to do, the prevailing party, they're going to challenge that on issue preclusion or claim preclusion, and they're going to win because you've already had your day in court. And your day in court is this, quote-unquote, mediation process. So that is what this will do. That is the effect. All these things that I believe it misleads voters, and I rather than just articulate them, they're on page 7 of the motion. They go into great detail about the different things that I think it fails to express and do. But this clearly eliminates the civil service system. It's just the effect of it. That's what this does. The civil service system gives you the opportunity to go from administrative law judge and appeal that decision to the personnel board and take that to the court system. This doesn't exempt that out. It should have, but it doesn't. So what does that mean? It means that's the effect. You don't have to have this litigated to understand that's what this does. These aren't just hypotheticals. They are the implicit realities of it. There's no process in here that gives you the ability to challenge that mediator's decision. But you know what? In the new measure that you may see down the road that's been filed, it does specify an appellate process, clearly specifies the time period, the fact you get to go up to the Court of Appeals, It lays that out. Why? Because this is a constitutional amendment that doesn't clarify it, and you know what? Legislature doesn't get to fix this. But you can by granting the motion for rehearing and allowing the proponents of this to get this right.
Thank you. I'll turn to board discussion. Any discussion by the board? I think I'll start in this case. I do see this as a single subject. I think it's about just cause, requiring just cause in all employment. And although it may be, I don't know, I suggested to Mr. Gruskin that maybe the purpose is to eliminate the at-will doctrine. I don't know. It's just as easily stated, I think, that the purpose is to require just cause. They're kind of two sides of the same coin. And it just seems to me that what the measure does is require just cause for employment terminations or actions. And everything else seems to be kind of an effect from that. It does have an impact on the state personnel system, but that's an employment situation. And it seems to me that the proponents can, whatever standards that they want to apply to actions against employees, they can apply that to the state personnel system as well. That's just kind of the way I'm looking at it, is that it's about just cause, and that the other things that are identified in the motion for rehearing are not really separate subjects, but effects of the measure, which the Supreme Court has, I think, given us some guidance to believe that those are not necessarily separate subjects. So that's kind of my point of view at this point. Any other discussion?
I agree with your conclusion, but there are two parts of this that would trouble me, and I certainly sounds like there's something that may be a better option out there in the future, but the arguments really to me go more to the merits than to the single subject issue. I mean, if this really did change the entire civil service system, I would have trouble with it, although I probably would agree with Mr. Gruskin that you could do that in a measure, but I would think that might be, this measure doesn't do it clearly enough. I would think that would be a hidden impact that would really trouble me, and I would think that would be kind of a surreptitious thing. And so the way I interpret it is more consistent with Mr. Gruskin, that in order partly at least to avoid that very problem, a court is unlikely to try to apply this to the civil service section, would instead read the two provisions of the Constitution so they aren't read to conflict with each other, and apply this only to those parts, those employers to which the civil service amendment doesn't apply. Similarly, if this, as I said, really did remove these cases completely from the court system, create only one way to resolve employment disputes, I would be troubled by that. But Mr. Gruskin assured me that that's not a proper interpretation. I think it's ambiguous at best on that, and so similarly, I think the proper interpretation is that it wouldn't create that problem. And so since I interpret it as not causing those problems, it does seem to meet the single subject requirement.
Any comment, Mr. Carton?
I think that, and I think I articulated this in our last meeting on this. I think the measure, without a doubt, if we're, it may be conjecture, but I do think that it does, by the plain language of the measure, will have a number of effects. And whether those effects amount to purposes that are interrelated, if they're interrelated, they're hidden. Again, it's not that I'm unwilling to do the work. It's just that I think that as a title board member, that there's a tension there between kind of going through that exercise and the line of cases that say that we that the title board should afford generally the proponent the benefit of the doubt in moving forward with an initiative. Would a state employee voting on this measure who is supportive of discharge for cause be surprised to learn that their administrative process and due process under the relevant board personnel board rules and has been impacted and perhaps removed and replaced by this? Would they be surprised? They might. Again, I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of reluctant to go down the road of kind of speculating on who would be surprised and what amounts to a hidden purpose in the coils of a measure. I do, again, I think there are a number of effects here. I do think that they relate to a single subject. I think the single subject is articulated in the title that was set by the board at the last meeting. I'm respectful of Mr. Friedenash's arguments with regard to multiple his single subject argument and also with his arguments relevant to the text of the title set by the board. I think the title accurately reflects the measure. I also think that the changes that were made by the proponents before, after the review and comment meeting and before submittal to the title board were in response to the questions and comments of the legislative staff. And so for those reasons, although, again, I think that a measure like this, it has a number of impacts, and but I'm reluctant to say that those, whatever effects, whatever purposes, are somehow unrelated or that there are some hidden purposes. At this point, I don't see that with this measure, and so I would stay with my vote the last time and find that this has a single subject.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll go ahead and make a motion then. I'll move that the board deny the motion for rehearing.
Second.
That's been moved and seconded. Any further discussion?
Can I just say that I'm starting to be a little bit troubled by the fact that the three of us seem to have some serious disagreements about what this actually would do, which suggests to me we may not understand it as well as we might, but I'm still not quite far enough along to vote no, although I'm getting nervous.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And that concludes action on number 62. The time is 12:37 p.m. Thank you very much.
Thank you.